Welcome to the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, where it's all about slashing your debt, slashing your taxes, and creating a liberated lifestyle. And now, your host, who has a vast collection of vintage DC and Marvel comic books, and ironically lives in Minnesota, where his favorite NBA team, the LA Lakers, originated, Dave Denniston.
Hello, my friends. This is Dave Denniston, and welcome back to another episode of the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, a podcast dedicated to helping doctors like you slash your debt, slash your taxes, and live a liberated lifestyle. Well, I am honored to have here with me today a gentleman introduced to me by one of my partners. He is someone that has specialized as a business broker in medical practices here in the state of Minnesota and Wisconsin. He's with a company called Sunbelt Advisors, and as he and I got to chat a little bit, I thought he'd be a great guest to put on the podcast. Help me welcome Randy Crevo. Welcome, Randy.
Well, thanks, Dave, and I'm certainly honored to be part of the podcast.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on, Randy, and give us a little thumbnail sketch. What's your background, and how did you get into business brokering and particularly medical practices?
Sure. Yeah, no, really, really good question, Dave. I'm, I would say by definition, a serial entrepreneur. I've owned a number of businesses over the years. I realized early on that working in corporate America and pulling a paycheck on a weekly or biweekly basis just isn't something that I was, meant to be for me. And I think 1989 was the last time that I actually was on somebody's payroll. So by definition, I guess I would qualify as an entrepreneur. And, having owned a number of businesses, one of the businesses that I owned a few years back was a consulting business. And I had a couple of clients that were in the healthcare community and gave me a much deeper, stronger understanding of kind of the ins and outs and the economics of medical practices in particular. And when I decided to make a shift and move over into business brokerage about 6 years ago, having that industry knowledge, what I didn't really know at the time, Dave, I'd like to say it was a great plan that I moved over to business brokerage to specialize in medical practices. I realized that certainly here in Minnesota and Wisconsin, there really was a lack of licensed brokers that are actually here in the states, Minnesota, Wisconsin, that could represent practice owners in transition and also find a way to assist those looking to buy in or buy practices. So I was able to leverage what I had known as being a business owner and combine that with some healthcare industry-related experience and carved out a specialty here in the marketplace in helping buyers and sellers alike that are in the medical field.
I love it. That's great. And how active, is that marketplace? Is there a lot of activity? Give us a handle on what it's like from your perspective.
Yeah, I mean, fortunately for me as a business broker and for my clients, the marketplace is pretty much red hot at the moment. And I think that's for a couple of reasons. I mean, first of all, the economy certainly has rebounded nicely from the Great Recession that we had. It's hard to believe it's been, about 10 years since that happened. It felt like it was a lot shorter, time period than that ago. But the marketplace has certainly rebounded well in terms of those with money, whether it's private equity groups or banks, large corporations, strategic buyers. There's a significant appetite to buy businesses in general right now. Interest rates are still at some historically low levels. There's a lot of confidence in the health of the economy. So it's driven a lot of purchase activity. And, on top of that, we have a lot of buyers in the marketplace that maybe 5-6 years ago either didn't have the confidence or didn't have the capital that they have today. So just in general, it's a very, very hot period of time right now for business owners, practice owners, in terms of seeing a lot of transactions taking place. So, that's certainly been good for the marketplace in general. But in specific, when we start looking in the medical side of things, medical practices, I would say the level of activity is probably a little bit higher and hotter than the market in general, only because there's a lot of money out there on the sidelines through private equity firms that have seen the financial benefit of consolidating certain areas of healthcare, where if you could take a handful of practices, say, in, for example, you know, dermatology, and create a regional presence and over time create that into a national presence, they just see a lot of opportunity to consolidate costs, increase efficiency and productivity, ideally still provide the same level of patient care, but do so at a reduced cost. And if you can do that, it's a great financial model for folks with money that are looking for, you know, the next opportunity in terms of getting a nice return on investment. So we've seen, certainly in the last 5 years, I'd say a heightened level of activity when it comes to change of ownership in medical practices.
So it sounds like, from what you're describing, that I would call it a seller's market. So
absolutely right.
When you say hot, you know, I think of people getting premium prices for their practices. And what kind of multiples do you use when you're looking at medical practices? Are you looking at net income? Are you looking at revenue? You know, what kind of figures are typically being used today?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I mean, ultimately, it's going to come down to net income. When whether it's an individual buyer who's looking to purchase their first practice, all the way up through private equity groups that are, you know, literally throwing billions of dollars into healthcare-related purchases each year, ultimately they've got to get a return on their investment. And if they can't identify the true income of the practice, it's pretty hard to put a value on it and come up with a transaction price. And I really like to kind of, Dave, carve this out into two different segments. You've got the large multi-location practices. You've got basically networks that have built up over time that may be worth in the tens of millions or even hundreds of millions of dollars. These types of practices command a substantial premium. They're typically going to sell on some multiple of EBITDA, which I know you know what that is. Some of your listeners may not, but that's earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, and amortization. That's the number that these larger transactions are being gauged against. And we're actually seeing some pretty crazy numbers out there. I've seen practices sell for as much as a 15 times multiple of EBITDA, which is, it's an insane number, to be honest with you. And the only way that those numbers ever really come about is if it's a substantially large practice and you've got a strategic buyer that wants in a big way. And, you know, what I like to say is, go ahead.
Let me interrupt you real quick. So if 15 is on the real high end, mm-hmm. what's kind of the low end right
sure.
now?
Sure. Yeah, probably about five.
Five. What about like 10 years ago? Because I want to give people some perspective. You know,
oh, yeah,
we're looking kind of 5 to 15. What was it like 10 years ago?
10 years ago is probably closer to 3 to 4 on the low end. And occasionally maybe something would happen north of a 10 multiple. So, yeah, you've seen maybe upwards of a 50% premium for a practice that had the same numbers 10 years ago that it has today, and that's just being driven by market forces. But the big caveat I want to throw in there is the type of practices that are commanding those types of premiums are practices that are absolute leaders in their respective marketplace. And they're an attractive acquisition candidate because they would qualify for what a private equity firm would refer to as a platform investment. So here in the Twin Cities, if a PE firm wanted to come in and establish a foothold in the dermatology market or orthopedics or whatever, and they don't have a presence yet, they're going to seek out a practice that is a leader, that's got some size to it, multiple locations. They're willing to overpay for that first purchase to establish a platform in the marketplace. And then once they have a foothold, then they start looking at adding on to that. In some cases, you're dealing with solo practitioner size practices. It may be other multiple location practices. But I can guarantee you they're not going to pay a 15 multiple for that second and third and fourth purchase. So that's why, you know, for your audience, when you start hearing some of these crazy numbers, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners have heard some of these kind of numbers, it really is the very, very top end, the tip of the pyramid. It's not commonplace. You have to have a certain level of attractiveness to command that. So, you know, if somebody's trying to put a number on what they think their practice is worth, don't use a 15 multiple of EBITDA as your expectation.
And just to give folks an idea, I just wrote down some numbers. So let's say your EBITDA, your earnings before interest and taxes and depreciation and amortization was $1 million. And often, from what I understand too, Randy, that you would take off the owner draw or owner salary of these numbers too.
Well, right? And that's why I wanted to make a distinction in the segments. For these larger transactions, no, you don't. It's strictly EBITDA. But when you start getting to smaller size practices, and I always hate, you know, I hate the word small, because what's small to one person is large to another. And I always never, ever want to insult somebody to call their practice to be small, okay? But it's how the marketplace defines things. And a small practice is typically anything from a solo practitioner size practice to maybe something that has three or four physicians, three or four doctors. You start getting above that, you start getting to larger size practices. But when you're in these smaller size practices, then you're right. We go off of a different number. We refer to it as SDE, or seller's discretionary earnings. It's the same thing as net cash flow to the owner. In that case, you're right. We would make an additional adjustment to factor in whatever compensation the owner was paying himself or herself. We would add that to the EBITDA number. So in the example you just gave, if a practice had $1 million of EBITDA, but were considered a smaller size practice, and the owner is paying himself or herself $300,000 of compensation between salary and retirement fund contributions and health insurance, things like that, then yeah, we would add that $300,000 to the million and say it's $1.3 million of seller's discretionary earnings. However, you don't apply the same multiple to that number. The multiples are lower.
The multiples are lower. Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, just give everyone an idea of when we're talking those multiples, because I want to give everyone a concrete example. So let's say a business had $1 million EBITDA, and it was going originally 10 years ago at that 3X range.
Right.
That would mean it's worth $3 million 10 years
yes.
ago. Whereas
mm-hmm.
now, let's say the earnings are still the same before EBITDA, before interest, taxes, depreciation,
yep.
amortization, and it's going at a 5X multiple, that's $5 million now. So even though
mm-hmm.
the earnings hadn't changed in this example, the practice
the
increased by $2 million, you know, 60%,
yep.
66% in this particular case. So you can see that in order to finance that, in order to make it work, it's going to be a much different animal than it was a few years ago. So seller's market. Now let's talk about from the perspective of the buyer. And some of these offers, you know, let's just use that 5X multiple as an idea. $5 million is the valuation of the practice. With as hot of a market as it is, you know, there's three different ways that I can consider structuring a deal like this, Randy. One is cash, which sellers mm-hmm. love. Sellers love
right.
to get paid in cash and get paid in full. Another mm-hmm. is a promissory note of some sort, where mm-hmm. you have owner financing, where the owner is allowing the person essentially to lend them money on the mm-hmm. deal without yep. having to go to a bank. And the third is earnout, is kind of the
yes.
way I consider it, which, of course, the cash could be, you know, you get a loan from the bank or something potentially as well. But the previous owner walks away with a lump sum. Are
yep.
there any other ways you can think of how the deals get divvied up? Are those three pretty much it?
That's pretty much it. I mean, sometimes you may have some different descriptives put to something like an earnout. You know, I've seen quite a few deals in which an associate has been with the practice for a few years, And then there's an agreement in place to allow him or her to buy in a certain percentage of the practice over time. And it may be based on some, you know, agreed upon salary range over the next 5 years. And the salary may be at a discount to the marketplace in order to provide for equity over time. You know, so I would say that's a fairly common tool that's used, especially if a doctor has found a practice that's a really, really good fit for him or her. The practice owner or owners, partners often, like the fact that this is the next generation coming through and would be a great owner, because what we see a lot of, Dave, is multi-generational ownership, to where you may have one of the owners that has reached retirement age, have a couple other partners that are maybe 10 or 15 years away, and you've got others that are maybe 30 years away. So for these larger practices, they're always looking for the next generation of ownership, and often have attractive packages in place to allow for the doctor to buy in typically over time. And some of it may be performance-based, not just, you know, in your example, if the practice was valued at $1 million and there's five partners, hence it's going to cost you $1 million to buy out one of the five partners. It doesn't have to be a finance transaction. It could be a combination of an earn-out, combination of performance over time. Quite often there is a loan that's provided to the buyer that does get paid off over time, but that loan may have a feature that doesn't require any type of payments against it for a period of time. Because I think what, you know, the marketplace understands is so many of the next generation of practice owners are so saddled with student loan debt that if they were to go out into the open market and try and borrow money from a bank, as other prospective business owners do, they're typically way behind the eight ball because of the enormous amount of debt that's out there or that they have to, you know, deal with. So that's why buying into a practice over time, if you're already part of the practice, is one of the more convenient routes. The only challenge I see with that is it's a pretty limiting route, because that kind of, if that's what you feel is your only way that you can step in and own a practice, well, it's got to be the one practice you work at. So it kind of limits your options. On the other hand, if you have access to capital, if you're able to borrow the money necessary to purchase the practice of your choosing, you're no longer beholden to that one set of circumstances. You literally can shop the market and find a practice that fits your needs the best and hopefully is priced in a manner that you feel, you know, makes the most sense. And, you know, certain fields that are out there, in particular, optometry, dentistry, veterinarian practices, I think we're starting to see some of this also in dermatology, that even if the buyer is saddled with a ton of student loan debt, as long as they've got a decent credit score and they can demonstrate that if they buy the practice, there's enough cash flow to service the debt and for them to, you know, maintain their current lifestyle, banks will often lend up to 100% of the purchase price of the practice.
But
in those industries. Well, actually, what I've seen is up to 110%. I've seen where they will – so let's use the $1 million example. Well, let's use $1 million as an example, period, a $1 million transaction. So – what I've seen in certain sectors is the bank lending the doctor the $1 million to buy the practice and throwing in some working capital. Depending on the requirements, it could be another $100,000, $150,000 of working capital. They'll roll all that into a $1,150,000 loan and allow the seller to cash out 100%. So that's out there. Now, that's not across the board. It's not, you know, every medical practice. I mean, something as an example, like a medical spa would not qualify for that. However, a medical spa would in all likelihood qualify for SBA financing, in which the buyer would need to come up with a 10% down payment. And that would be enough to qualify to do a $1 million transaction.
So let me just take a step back here for a second. We talked about this being a hot market overall, especially for certain practices. Do you find that the majority of transactions today are just all cash deals? Or,
no.
You know, what would be, let's just say, because many of our listeners might want to more buy a smaller practice rather than a gigantic practice. So maybe it might be on the 5x multiple range.
Sure.
What would you say on average for those smaller practices? What's a typical valuation, knowing that every situation is different, but just give us an average. You know, what would be a typical transaction?
First of all, on a smaller, let's go to the extreme small end. Let's call it a solo practitioner practice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's generating $1 million of revenue. I mean, we're probably talking about a transaction that's somewhat south of $1 million. It might be a $750,000 transaction. Mm-hmm. That's going to be valued on that SDE number, seller's discretionary earnings, not EBITDA. And those are typically, you're going to see things more in the 3x multiple of SDE. So, of an example we were talking about earlier, Dave, $100,000 of net income, and the owner is pulling out $250,000 for themselves, so $350,000. So that practice would probably sell somewhere close to the $1 million range.
Gotcha.
Okay. And depending on what kind of practice it is, it may qualify for 100% bank financing. But if we look at all the different sectors and all the different types of medical practices, I'd say probably fewer than 20% wind up qualifying for that 100%. But almost everyone would qualify for SBA-backed financing, in which the owner or the buyer needs to come up with a 10% down payment. So, it's certainly feasible for somebody to buy in, but they have to come up with the down payment. So that gets to one of the options that you mentioned earlier, which I see quite a bit, and that's basically the seller agreeing to be the bank and saying, if we can agree on $1 million price for my practice, I'll sell it to you, understanding that cash is really, really tight for you at the moment. I'll go ahead and play the bank. And typically what a bank is going to do is offer a 10-year term on a note. And what I see that happens a lot when the seller becomes the bank is they'll amortize the note over 10 years and say, I'll give you the same monthly payment that the bank would be giving you. However, I want a balloon payment after 5 years. I want this loan to be paid off at a point in time in which you've had plenty of time to get your feet underneath you, to build up your finances. If you're as successful as I've been, you're going to be sitting on a nice, you're going to have a nice pot of cash sitting in your bank account 5 years from now. You'll be able to either pay me off, or you can easily go to a bank and get a loan necessary to pay off the balloon. So to me, that's a real nice win-win deal structure, to where the seller is going to get paid within 5 years. The buyer isn't paying such an onerous monthly payment that they're struggling to make ends meet, because let's face it, if they're struggling to make ends meet, they're never going to buy the practice, and that's not good for the seller. They'll never sell their practice. So I do see quite a, the other thing too is if you keep the bank out of it, now you can throw in some things like the earnout that you talked about. Mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of deals in which there's a fundamental disagreement between the buyer and the seller, and it's often not between them. It's often their accountants and their tax advisors that have, they have each of their clients' best interests at heart. And, the seller's advisor is trying to do everything they can to maximize the value that they're getting for the practice and vice versa, right? So that's where the earnout becomes a really nice way to bridge a gap. So the example we're just talking about, $1 million valued practice, the buyer may be getting advice from his or her advisor saying you really shouldn't be paying a penny more than $800,000. And the seller's like, no, I mean $1 million is what it's worth, but here's what I'll do. How about if you agree to pay me the $800,000 and then another $200,000 on an earnout provided certain performance metrics are made. And for me, that's a great way to bridge the gap. If the practice is as good as the seller says it is, he or she's going to make the earnout. And if it is as good as he or she says it is, the buyer should be willing to pay that extra premium because it proved out to be a good practice. So,
is the earnout usually revenue-based, net income-based? You know, tell
sure.
us about more what that looks like. And I'll give an example from personal experience. So, you know, $1 million practice, let's say, and then let's say 33% was cash down payment, 33% mm-hmm. was a promissory note, and mm-hmm. then 33% was, or 34% would be earnout.
Yeah.
So
right.
So 34% of $1 million gives us $340,000. Mm-hmm. If we divide that over 5 years, that mm-hmm. gives us, let's just call it $70,000 just to make it a nice
That's fine.
Round
yeah.
number. And that the revenue we had said was around
$1 million.
$1 million revenue. So that would be, if we divide it by revenue, that gives us about 7%. Of revenue would be paid to the previous owner over a period of 5 years.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, the thing that's really difficult about earnouts is how do you make it fair to both parties?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right? So, I mean, ideally, in an ideal world, you would want the earnout based on some type of profit number. Right? If I'm buying a practice, I mean, yes, it's important that I reach $1 million of revenue each of the next 5 years, but the revenue is just the starting point. It doesn't guarantee me that I'm going to take any of that home with me.
Right.
So, you know, and granted, we're in a period of time in which there's a lot of variables that are going to impact profitability that are outside of the control of the buyer or the seller. But what I always like to say is, if I'm the seller, and I'm going to agree to an earnout, unless I'm going to stay on board in some very meaningful role afterwards, I have zero control over how the buyer is going to run the practice. And if the buyer runs the practice by changing the billing system and, you know, having a cousin do all the billing and 6 months later it's just in shambles and, you know, profits, you know, down the drain, but the revenue's still there, well, why should I be on the hook for a bad business decision that's impacting profits? And I always like to say, in my opinion, the more fair earnouts are the ones that are tied to a number closest to the top line. So I see a lot of earnouts pegged strictly on revenue mm-hmm. because that allows the buyer to do pretty much whatever they want to do, to run the practice, to upgrade equipment, to spend whatever they want to spend on the practice, and not have the seller going, well, wait a minute, your expenses are out of control. You're killing my earnout. I've also seen kind of the middle ground gross profit. So literally sales minus cost of goods mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Equaling gross profit become a metric that's used in earnouts. Mm-hmm. But whether I'm representing the buyer or the seller, I always like to peg it on a revenue number because I think that's the most neutral that parties can agree to. And then it really becomes a matter of, well, how do you set the number? Is it hitting the same revenue number that the practice has had historically? Is it the earnouts kicks in once that number is bettered? You know, in the $1 million practice, let's just say that over the last 3 years it went from 800 to 900 to a million. Well, the earnout might be set at $1.1 million because that's the trajectory that the practice is on. And if it's on that trajectory, the practice may be priced at a higher value based on that future performance expectation. So I think without getting too deep into the weeds, the thing that's great about an earnout is it's something that can be agreed to by both parties. Hopefully it's an easy number to measure. It's an easy number to identify, that somebody doesn't have to hire outside auditors every year to come up with what the earnout number is, and that it's fair. And again, I've seen that used countless times as a great way to bridge the gap between pricing, you know, the price expectation of the buyer versus the seller. And as long as you make an earnout that both parties want it to be met, then it's a good earnout.
Well, and the way I always look at it, too, it's a win-win situation. If the practice grows, you know, everyone benefits. I would say I bought a business myself that was an online business, and I was hoping that the previous seller that I bought the business from would be incentivized by the earnout.
Sure. Yep.
But he didn't really seem to be as incentivized as I thought he would.
And yeah, so, I mean, we like to call that skin in the game, right? If the seller knows that he or she is going to benefit in the future by ongoing strong performance of the business they just sold, chances are they're going to be available to take that phone call 6 months from now when an issue arises that you would want their input on. The other thing, too, about the earnout, before I forget, is I always like to, I mean, if you think about the business that you bought and that had an earnout to it, you know, 5 years removed, there's so little of what's going on in that business at that juncture that anything to do with the prior owner.
True.
Versus that first month, okay, that owner probably still has his or her fingerprints all over the business or all over the practice and is in a position to more effectively control the performance. And as you get further and further removed from the sale of the practice, the further removed the owner has on having any influence whatsoever on the earnout. So I like to see earnouts that are weighed more heavily in the first year and less heavily as time goes on.
That's a fair point. I think that's a very fair point. Interesting way to structure it, too.
And now let's take a moment for a quick commercial break. Well, my friends, 4 years into this podcasting journey, I have accumulated tons and tons and tons of material from my guests, from books I've written, and everything else. And so I have created a whole system for you that I call the Freedom Formula for Physicians Prosperity Kit. This kit is every single thing that I've ever created. So if you are wanting to get an edge on your finances, if you are wanting to get that financial education all in one place, all in one box, I'm throwing the whole kitchen sink at you. My latest book, The Young Physician's Guide to Money and Life. My first book, The Freedom Guide, The Freedom Formula for Physicians. I'm going to throw in the audio CDs. I'm going to throw in copies of podcasts. I'm going to throw in a USB drive with tons and tons of material on it. I'm going to throw in workbooks that have other published works that I have had. Anything and everything that I have done is in this system, and it is less than $100. $99.87 will get you 4 years worth of my blood, sweat, and tears to help you move yourself forward. And as a special bonus, I'm going to include more about my land investing journey, what's been going on there, give you an inside scoop as to the latest and greatest and things that you might want to learn as you go along. So with that, my friends, if you are interested in moving forward, go to drfreedompodcast.com/system. Again, drfreedompodcast.com/system. drfreedompodcast.com/system. And now back to the show.
So would you say, is in this hot market, are those common at all? Or because the market is so hot, you know, the way I imagine it, the best businesses are probably cash offers quite often to allow the owner to step away. And that's what a seller wants, right? They want the whole cash and walk away.
Well, the only way that they're going to cash out is if they're in a sector like optometry or dentistry, where there's that kind of financing available from the bank. In most other disciplines, that is not available. So the people that have the money to do all cash transactions are typically private equity groups or large corporate strategic buyers.
Like a hospital system has been
very common. But they're typically not the type of buyer that's going to buy a small practice. It's just not worth their time and effort, for the most part, to buy a $1 million practice if they've already got a $500 million healthcare system. It doesn't move the needle for them. So in reality, these smaller, especially you start getting to more the solo practitioner size practices, it's in all likelihood going to be an individual buyer that comes in to purchase, and they're not going to have cash, at least certainly not the cash available to write a check at closing. So if they can't get bank financing, then they need to structure a deal where the owner becomes the bank, provides a promissory note, you know, perhaps throws the earnout on there. And that's where the earnout thing or component, Dave, has become more prevalent, because on the surface, one thing that any of your practice owners out there that are listening have to take into account is the buyer needs to be able to afford the purchase.
Yeah.
You know, it's one thing to say, right? I mean, it's one thing to say that the practice is worth $1 million, but my God, I'm in a hot market and I'm going to go for $1.3 million and I'm just going to impose my will on that first buyer that wants my practice bad enough. They'll pay that price. But the economic reality is when you start to take into account for the debt service at $1.3 million, and especially, and odds are that buyer has student loan debt, and probably some significant student loan debt. At the end of the day, the buyer can't afford to pay $1.3 million for the practice. It doesn't matter if the seller is willing to be the bank. The numbers ultimately don't work out. It becomes prohibitively expensive to own a practice under that scenario versus, you know, stay on as a doctor or physician somewhere else and get paid. Because net-net, you may be making more as an employee versus owning a practice if you're paying too much for the practice.
Well,
so the market has a great way of equalizing these things.
Well, I think here's an interesting way to just kind of pencil this out using our previous example, which would be a very high down payment of 33%.
Right. Yeah.
But essentially, if we use that example in this case, the deal has 33% on a note and 34% of an earnout.
Mm-hmm.
And if we use that example where you had $250K of owner salary and then $100K of profit from the prior person, well, there's $350K that
right.
is assumed to be the net income. Well, if
yep.
you are paying $70,000 of earnout,
right.
and then you add on a promissory note of $330,000, the length of that note and the interest rate charged on that note could really vary how the practice works. So
absolutely.
You know, something I would be thinking about if I was buying a practice would be playing around with that calculator. So if you just do a search for amortization calculator
sure,
to give an idea – as a buyer, you know, I'm just going to put an example here of $333,000 loan. If we spread it out over 10 years and make it a 5% rate, that gives me $3,500 a month or so.
Sure.
If you make that interest rate 8% rather than 5%,
which where we're headed, yep.
Now you're looking at $4,000 a month.
Yeah.
So
it adds up fast.
It adds up quick.
So, no, you're right. I mean, that's – so whenever I meet with a doctor that's thinking about buying a practice, that's one of the very first things that we sit down and we talk about is we need to understand what kind of cash flow you need from a practice to make sense, right? So what I've seen practice owners or buyers become a practice owner. They may buy a small practice, and they may only be working there 2 or 3 days a week while they're continuing to work their current practice where they've got health care insurance and some other things,
right.
and they grow that practice to become a full-time practice.
Yes.
I see that it's quite common to see it quite often. The other thing, though, that it's one of these things that I think you and I as business owners understand intuitively, that owning a business isn't just about having, you know, getting the cash flow from the business, that's an important part of it. But if you buy somebody else's business, or in this case, you buy somebody else's practice, and you run the numbers, and you can see that over the course of the next 10 years, you can service the debt, you can pull out enough money from the practice to where you're not taking a step back in your lifestyle requirements, which might include not only student loan debt, but mortgage payments, whatever. If you can say, you know what, net-net, I'm no worse off financially from owning a practice versus staying on as an employee somewhere. But the one thing, for some reason, that prospective buyers fail to take into account is the big difference is 10 years from now, you're going to own that practice free and clear.
Right.
You know, and if you buy a $1 million practice, chances are that practice 10 years from now is going to be worth more than $1 million. And if you kind of fall into the argument of, well, why would I take on the challenge of practice ownership if financially, you know, I'm really no better off, no worse, no better than I am today based on what I'm being paid as an employee. Well, you got to factor in two things. Number one, 10 years from now, you're going to be immeasurably better off because you own that asset free and clear. And, oh, yeah, by the way, over the next 10 years, you get to practice medicine the way you want to practice it. You know, I have yet to meet a doctor that I've worked with that hasn't said one of the reasons why I'd like to own my own practice is there's just certain things that I know we could be doing better or differently at the practice I work at now, and no one's listening to me. You know, this is the way it's done. You know, they pat me on the head going, you know, you're the newbie here. But, you know, a lot of the next generation of practice owners have come out of school with, in many cases, a refreshingly different approach to how they want to practice medicine. And if you own your own practice, guess what? You get to decide how you want to practice. So you also got to kind of factor in the, you know, I don't know if it's necessarily, I won't call it the enjoyment factor, but the fulfillment factor, that when you show up to your own practice, you get to call the shots in terms of the processes, procedures, how patients are treated, handled, et cetera. So that's an intangible that I don't know how to put a number on, but I think it's pretty valuable and tangible.
I think that's great. I think that's all great advice. I guess as we wrap up here today, I guess the other big piece of advice I would give to everybody is, as you look at the numbers, you know, run a worst case scenario. Don't just look at it with rose colored glasses.
Yes.
If the practice revenue drops by 30%, what does that look like? You know, could you still live with those numbers?
That's phenomenal advice, because, you know, nobody has a crystal ball. None of us know what the future is going to hold. Fortunately, a lot of the practices that I've been involved with, both from the buy and the sell side, the transactions have been really good, solid transactions. There hasn't been any major surprises 6 months or a year later in which you see a 30% drop. But guess what? It can happen. It absolutely could. It could be somebody you never thought about, or, you know, you buy a practice in a great location and somebody sets up a competing practice right across the hall from you. I mean, you're like, great. I mean, how's that for timing? There's stuff you can't control. So, yes, from a financial planning standpoint, you absolutely need to take a look at you want to call it a worst case scenario, or perhaps a realistic downside scenario, and make sure you can withstand that. Otherwise, maybe practice ownership isn't the right move, or go find another practice that gives you more cushion.
Or look at increasing the earnout or something like that. You know,
exactly.
The other piece to that. But I like the idea of having a higher earnout in year one. That was a different thought I hadn't heard before. So
cool.
That was great.
Yeah.
So I guess, Randy, this is we're running at the end of our time today. Do you have any final thoughts that you want to leave with us?
Boy, I tell you, we've covered a lot of ground, and you've asked some insightful questions that I think has probably pulled the information from me that I otherwise would have talked about anyhow. I mean, I just think that, you know, perhaps, you know, parting piece of advice is, A, if you're a practice owner, the best time to sell your practice isn't the day you think about selling. Start thinking about it a couple years ahead of time. Get it prepared to sell. Get an idea of, truly understand what it's worth, and sit down with your financial planner and make sure that number would work for you if you decide to sell a practice. And you don't want to sell a practice that hasn't been positioned for sale, ideally. I mean, granted, life gets in the way, and, you know, sometimes things happen unexpectedly and you're put in a position where you need to sell a practice, but get out in front of it. I like to encourage people to be at least 5 years out in front of the time that they're ready to sell. So when they do come to market, they're going to get more for their practice by positioning it properly and taking note of the things that a buyer is going to wind up dinging them for and discounting the value. And then on the flip side, same thing for buyers. Take your time. Even if you think you're 5 years out from buying a practice, now's the time to start understanding how that works. You know, banks will sit down with a doctor at any point in time and help walk them through what their requirements are, you know, how they would look at financing a practice. You know, start the process of identifying what a practice would look like for you that you'd want to own, and not feel like you're rushed into making a decision. So for me, get out in front of it. The more time you put into either thinking about buying a practice or being prepared for selling a practice is going to make, A, the process go by a lot more smoothly, and B, you're going to have, you know, so many fewer regrets afterwards by going, geez, I wish I'd have thought about that. If you get out in front of it, you'll think about all that before you finally sign a check at the closing table and have practice ownership change hands.
I think that's all phenomenal mentorship, and thank you so much for being with us, Randy. Where can people find you if they have other questions, if they want to maybe sell their practice or looking to buy in a practice?
Sure, no, I appreciate that. Probably the easiest way to get a hold of me is via email. Like you and probably like so many of them, my days are spent in meetings and on the phone a lot. My email address is rkrivo, so R-K-R-I-V as in Victor O, at sunbeltmidwest.com.
All right. Well, there you go, folks. That wraps it up. Randy, thank you so much for being with us.
No, Dave, my pleasure. I appreciate you having me on, and hopefully some of your listeners were able to pick up a few tidbits along the way.
Absolutely. All right, my friends, well, that wraps it up for another episode of the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. You have questions about this, Randy is a great resource to point to. Obviously, he's done this more than just a couple of times. So get mentors as you look to make a move on buying or selling a practice. Have any other questions? Feel free to reach out to me, Dave, at drfreedompodcast.com. And remember, my friends, remember to slash your debt, slash your taxes, and live a liberated lifestyle.
All right, my friends, that wraps it up for today. And just want to remind you, make sure to check out everything that I have ever built in the last 4 years for this podcast. You can get it all for less than $100 by going to drfreedompodcast.com/system. Again, that's drfreedompodcast.com/system. Get the latest books, all the manuals, all the audio to get your financial education all in one place. Again, drfreedompodcast.com/system.